Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Aaron Jasper, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tailwaters. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Aaron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcription for this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Aaron Jasper about tailwaters. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Aaron, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawings tonight, we're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Aaron's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and then we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Aaron's new DVD, Mastering the Dead Drift, Indicator Nymphing Simplified and Perfected. So here's how you can win Aaron's new DVD. You just have to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something we talked about during the show. So you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. So the first one to do that correctly will win a copy of Aaron's new DVD, Mastering the Dead Drift. So use your best typing skills, take notes, listen carefully, and see if you can't win that new DVD that Aaron's coming out with. Tonight, our guest is Aaron Jasper. Aaron fishes an average of 200 to 250 days a year and has been fly fishing since the age of 7. Aaron has been fortunate enough to fish some of the greatest trout streams around the country, fishing extensively in the eastern United States, as well as traveling across the country to experience some of the very best fly fishing available out west. As a result of his travels, Aaron has learned many techniques, flies and rigs, which have enabled him to constantly grow and improve as a fly fisherman. In recent years, thanks to his very close friend, Davy Wooten, Aaron has become a true student of many European nymphing techniques and other methods of trout fishing, along with traditional style wet fly fishing. Aaron has become a great source of Euro nymphing knowledge as well. Aaron's always happy to demonstrate a variety of Euro nymphing techniques, from short line, short leader Polish and Czech methods to longer leader Spanish and French techniques. While this style of fishing is an investment to learn, it's very often unequaled in its fish catching potential. In 2007, along with his friend and web designer, Justin Massimo, Aaron founded Trout Predator Online, a fishing community specifically aimed at disseminating and sharing good information about fly fishing techniques and destinations. Since then, the community has grown to over 2,600 members and is home to some of the very best information on the web about Euro nymphing. Aaron and Justin produce multiple short videos every month on everything from fly tying tutorials and tips to short destination adventure videos. All can be found on their website, including information on Euro nymphing techniques. Well, Aaron, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, Roger. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good.
I hear it's cold out east, huh?
Oh, yeah, it was 11 this morning, and the walk from the parking lot to school was rough. I felt bad for the kids.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Aaron, today in the Rocky Mountains at 8,800 feet where I'm at, it was a balmy 50-some degrees. How's that?
It's not fair.
Not fair.
We'll shove it back over that way.
So tailwater fishing in Colorado today was kind of like the summertime.
Yeah, it was nice. It was pretty good today.
Yeah, it sure was. So
fishing anywhere today was terribly cold here.
Yeah. That's why I just turned off the news before I got on the show tonight, and it was like these frosted ice castles in Chicago or something. Like, oh, I feel sorry for those folks. But out west here, it's pretty nice, but we have no snow, which will mean no water for fish in the summertime, which is not good. So we're a little disturbed about that possibility, because we had a bad year last year as well out west, and so we need some water. Anyway,
we had a rough one this year too.
Pardon me?
Yeah, we had it rough with very little rain and very warm temperatures this year as well. So
yeah,
wasn't optimal.
No. Well, let's get going here. We got a lot of questions tonight. I think tailwaters is a popular topic, obviously, from the amount of questions we got in. And like we said in our little intro, it's a place you can fish almost all year round in many places in the world. So that gives us something to do in the wintertime when a lot of other areas are iced up or not fishable. So it'll be fun to talk about this. Not everybody's familiar with tailwater fisheries, so let's start out here, Aaron. The first question is from Jack in Louisiana. He says, I'm relatively new to fly fishing, and a lot of terms are somewhat unusual. So just what are tailwaters? I think that the term means the water found below the outlet of a dam, but I'm not sure. So you want to explain what tailwaters are and some of their characteristics?
Okay, well, what a tailwater is it's a dam that was built in a valley or a canyon to form a lake for a number of reasons. Some of the reservoirs were built for drinking water. Some reservoirs were built for flood control. Other ones were built, for flood control, and they have, they generate electricity, hydropower. Tailwater is generally, in a fly fisherman's sense, what we would consider a tailwater, a lake that is deep enough to have a thermocline, which means that the sunlight doesn't penetrate all the way through the water, and it creates a temperature break. And that's why tailwaters are very popular with fly fishermen. You have extremely stable temperatures and a very stable environment below the dam. So to make it pretty easy, it's a big lake formed by a dam that's quite deep, and the water does not get warm near the bottom, so that creates cool water coming out of the dam and a perfect habitat for trout. So in its simplest definition, that would be what a tailwater is.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming I've fished primarily tailwaters out west and have actually not fished any in the east or the south. Are there differences between tailwaters east to west, north to south? And if so, what kind of differences can we see in tailwaters?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's a east-west difference with the tailwaters. I would say that a lot of it has to do with the way the water is managed. For example, in the east, we have the west branch of the Delaware and the east branch, and they have very consistent releases, and the water is in the system for, hundreds of miles until the Delaware reaches, where it terminates into the Delaware Bay. So those tailwaters have quite long fisheries below their dams, okay? Now, in the west, the tailwaters, a lot of them, the streams below the dams, are used for irrigation. So what you start off with below the dam, for example, let's say they're releasing, I'll pick a number, 300 cubic feet per second. Now, 10 miles below the dam, that flow might be reduced to a trickle. So in the west, a lot of the tailwaters and the demands for water there are based on irrigation, with the exception of many of the reservoirs in Colorado, where Denver and the other cities get the water. So there, what you see in Colorado, the water management's a lot different. And the fact that if they need water in one area, you might have increased flows in that section of stream. And that's why you see the Dream Stream, the South Platte, the 11-mile section. At different times of the year, those rivers have different amounts of water in them. And a lot of times there's no reason for it, because they just simply need to fill up one reservoir because the water demand there is greater, or it might be the lower reservoir in the system. And I saw a question about the Crone system in Westchester County, in Putnam County, New York. And to answer that one, a lot of the flows there are under the same regime. It's a drinking water from New York City. So there's about 20 million people in New York City. So they need to release the water at different times from different reservoirs to get the bottom reservoir in the system full so they can extract the water and send it to New York City for drinking water. So the flows there depend on some of its runoff and how high the water is above the dams, but a greater amount of the demand for water in those rivers comes from the actual need to get the water down to a reservoir where they can funnel it down as drinking water through a tunnel, you know, a large pipe.
But you did say that you thought that the east provided longer tailwaters, it sounded like, than the west?
I mean, yes,
around
generally.
Here you get about 7 miles down or so, and usually it's, you know, that's it's petered out.
Gone.
Yeah.
The water is gone. Yeah, no.
Yeah, gone or very warm at that point, yeah.
Well, in the east, we don't have irrigation, per se. We don't have large, you know, dikes built and, you know, irrigation canals built to bring water to farms. We don't have that in the, you know, it, nowhere near the extent that it is out west. Like, you know, you go to the Bighorn, and they might be releasing 3,000 CFS of water, but when you get 10 miles below the dam, you're down to 1,000 CFS because they're sending the other 2,000 CFS of water to all the farms in the area. So
right.
They take out a lot of the water, and that's why the water temperatures get warmer, because less water, lower flow, going slower warms up quickly. So that's
right.
One of the reasons why that happens.
So how, and that I guess answered Brian's question from Ohio. We got online here. He wanted to know the contrast. I didn't even know that we were answering his question until I saw it online here. That's good. So that is a big difference that could happen from east to west. So in general, do you feel like the water itself in the tailwater section where the water is still cold pretty much produces an environment that is pretty similar across the United States and Canada and other countries?
A lot of it depends on the depth of the lake. If the lake, let's say you have a lake that's 60 feet in depth. Now, that amount of cold water, I call it a bank, the, you know, the thermal bank, that's not going to last as long as a reservoir like the Bighorn, the, you know, Bighorn Lake. That lake is over almost 300 feet deep. So there's a lot more cold water below those dams. And I think that that's the larger difference between the tailwaters is the depth of the lakes and how much water they can actually store behind them. Because that translates into how much water they can divvy out through the season to keep those flows consistent. So that's where that comes from, in my opinion.
Well, also, too, the releases affect the tailwaters. I know, you know, you mentioned the Bighorn, and I was up there one year, unfortunately, in, like, July, and it is super hot. And they were not releasing, because of the lack of water, they were, you know, releasing very little water, which means there was very little water in the tailwater, even at the top, and it was very hot, the water. And so the fish were down, the fish were trying to get as deep as they could, they were off the bite. It really affected the river that year, and it was due to low releases in that situation. But so how would, there's one example of how, you know, releases might affect tailwaters. What about the higher releases and so forth and the effect on bugs and that kind of thing?
Most tail, well, we'll use the Bighorn for an example, then we'll move on to a different one. There's, in my opinion, two different distinct types of tailwaters. There's tailwaters, like the Bighorn, that get most of their food from in-stream production and call them autotrophic type fisheries, where the river is really wide open and the river creates a lot of its food from photosynthesis. The plants grow on the stream bed. And if you go to the Bighorn, you'll see there's tons of moss beds. There's lots of different grass. There's watercress in there. And that's where all the insects live. And in those types of tailwaters, you're going to have midges. You're going to have your sow bugs, your crest bugs, scuds, aquatic worms. And, you know, in the silty areas, you'll have the aquatic worms. You'll have, you know, a lot of midges, an abundance of midges, and you'll have very limited, however, dense hatches. And generally in the west, it's PMDs and blueing olives. And in the east, you'll have a lot of sulfurs and some caddis species and blueing olives again. So on a tailwater like that, where it's wide open, it comes from a deep lake, the food inputs are all in the stream. Now, if we go to something like the West Branch of the Delaware, it has both. In its upper reaches, the Lake Cannonsville Reservoir is pretty deep. And I like to use that as an example. A lot of people know about the river. So that lake is pretty deep. So what happens there is you have clean, cold water coming out of the bottom of the dam. Now, the river's wide open. There's not a lot of trees, which is, you know, very typical of tailwaters. They're very wide open, low gradient streams. So there in the upper reaches, you have a lot of, you know, sow bugs, aquatic worms, midges. You have sulfurs. You have tons of blueing olives. Very prolific hatches. Now, where the West Branch of the Delaware changes and becomes prolific is there's a brook that empties in at the top of the river. And what that brook brings with it is outside, for lack of a better word, inputs. Like leaves get deposited into the stream, they get carried in there, and that adds the nutrients that gives that river all the prolific insect activity that it has. So the longer a tailwater goes from the dam, the more food inputs it gets from outside that all the insects can eat, because the insects eat the decaying plant matter, so that's basically their food source. So the more that you have going into the stream, the more insects and the more diversity you'll generally have. So those are the two different, distinct different types of tailwaters that you'll see. You'll see ones where they get inputs from in the stream, lots of weed growth, and you'll see one with both, where the leaves fuel the insect, you know, the growth and the populations of the insects, and you'll have the in-stream food production with the weeds.
Now, I noticed some, well, for instance, have you fished the Blue River in Colorado below Lake Dillon? Yeah. And there you get the shrimp coming out of
the mysis shrimp, yes.
Yeah, the mysis shrimp. Now, I don't know if that's common in other places. I think it is in Colorado in the Taylor.
Yeah, it's the Taylor and the Frying Pan and the Blue River all have those.
Those mysis shrimp. Is that something specific to Colorado, or do you have those out east as well?
Not specific to Colorado.
Okay.
It's very specific to Colorado.
Do you have any other kind of scud production or shrimp production in the east along those
Yeah,
lines?
We'll have some, you know, scuds, like, you know, normal freshwater shrimp, you know, like little tan, olive, gray scuds. But you're not going to have the mysis shrimp. But the mysis shrimp are in those tailwaters because they come out of the base of the dam, the bottom of the dam.
Right.
So that's the lake actually fueling the river with food to feed those big fish. In the east, we don't have that. In the east, it's generally like in-stream food. There's not much coming through the bottom of the lake, with the exception of the White River and some of the other lakes that have alewives in them. Sometimes you'll get them coming out of the dam during periods of generation. However, that's not the norm. The you know, our fish are growing large, eating, you know, a diet of mainly insects.
Okay. What about heavy releases? Does that ever wash out the insect or the food sources for the insects and damage the river? Because I know, you know, like in, not that this is a, well, it may have, it does, there's a tailwater there too. Grand Canyon this year, they're talking about doing a major flood of the canyon, 40,000 CFS at one time going through the canyon. The last time I ran it, it was at 9,000. So that tells you how much more water they're going to pour through there. But there's a tailwater there below Lake Powell, Glen Canyon Dam. And I'm wondering when they blast that through there, if it's going to damage the fishery. Have you ever heard of or experienced anything like that?
Well, for one of my classes, I'm getting a master's in natural resource management. It's a stream ecology class. And I read a study done on Colorado River at Lee's Ferry. And when they built the dam, it was a tremendous tailwater fishery. However, some of the limiting facts, you know, some of the limiting things that were causing the stream to become less fertile and the fishery actually collapsed was that when they built the dam, there was sediment and silt throughout the stream course, and the food production wasn't that good. So what they did is they blew everything out. Now, with a lake that deep, there's very little sediment and silt coming through the dam. So they actually flushed the river out, and on average, I think it was almost 1.5 meters, so three, almost on average, the stream almost got around 4.5 to 5 feet deeper on average after, I'd like to say it was a 55,000 CFS release. So in those situations where you don't have a lot of silt coming in from other sources, a heavy dam release will blow out the silt and actually deepen the stream. So in that situation, it might help it out, because then you'll be down to the rocks and the cobble on the bottom, which will help the fish and insects grow. And the insects will adapt to the new environment. They won't be gone. They'll just simply adapt and find new habitat. And, you know, it might take a year for it to reconstruct to what it was, but it will return back to what it originally was, and a lot of times better. And the fish might grow larger because of that, because the insects will be more prolific.
Yeah, I think that's the purpose in the Grand Canyon is to, number one, recreate sandbars. It does a lot of habitat renewal, I guess, from what I understand, because when, you know, nature normally floods, and when you have these controls, then you don't get the floods, and so they have to artificially create the floods, and that kind of resets nature, I guess, in certain respects.
Well, another thing, too, with those dams, Roger, is it also depends on the size of the rocks that are in the stream. If you have a stream bed that's, you know, composed of rocks that are on average the size of a softball, it's going to be a lot harder and more difficult to move that around. It would require more force, like a greater release, than if we're talking about moving sand and small stones. You know, 40,000 CFS might do it. However, to move rocks on the bottom that would be, you know, baseball to softball size, it would require a much higher velocity than that.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of it depends on the size of the, you know, substrate in the stream.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Aaron, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back, and we'll dig into tailwaters a bit more here.
Yeah.
Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. They're located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com, or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Aaron Jasper about tailwaters. If you'd like to ask Aaron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Aaron, what's going on in your fly fishing world? I know you've got this new DVD coming out. Do you want to tell us about that?
One of the largest amounts of emails that I get during the year is to take people to tailwater fisheries. So, and how do you, you know, catch the fish there? Because they look on the website. And Alex and I were thinking of the next project to make, so we decided to fly around the country and film, you know, fishing on tailwaters. And something very interesting with the tailwater fisheries is they're generally lower gradient streams. So you would have to change your nymphing techniques. Like, for example, like, you know, in the beginning when you introduced me, you were talking a lot about the European styles of nymphing. That works well in some streams where there's lots of boulders, seams, current seams, where the fish are in a spot. These techniques in the DVD that we just got done making are geared towards, like, low-gradient streams where the holding areas aren't as defined. So that's about the DVD, but other than that, broke my arm in a car accident in October, so that kind of cut down on my fishing. Been writing a lot of articles. I'm working on a book. So there's a lot going on. I have more than enough stuff to do. And then couple that with school and school with the kids.
Right.
That's, you know,
you're very
enough.
Busy, it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah, too much sometimes.
So did you break your casting arm? Or?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah? Oh, geez.
Yes. So I tried to fish last weekend, but the tendons in the top of my wrist that, you know, go through my thumb to, you know, that area of my hand, when I make the end of the cast, it puts some great strain on it, and it feels like someone's, like, electroshocking me. So,
oh boy.
Not good.
Well, you better learn how to cast with the other arm, then. That's all there is to it.
Well,
simple.
I'm going to opt for the easy operation route, I think.
Okay.
I told the doctor, I said, I have to be able to cast. Like, I don't care what you have to do. Give me a new hand, as long as it'll cast.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good, good. Well, I'm glad you're keeping busy, and we'll look forward to all these new products you're coming out with, books, DVDs. That'll be fun. And tell everybody what the address of your website, because I don't think I dropped it earlier, where they can learn more about fly fishing.
Okay. The address for the forum is troutpredator.com, and you know, there's three boxes. There's the store, there's the website, and then there's the videos. The link to the forum is in the middle, and then the website for the DVD is www.thedeaddrift.com. So it's pretty easy, and I can't believe someone else didn't buy that URL.
Yeah.
We found it a week ago, so the DVD is on sale. We'll have it tomorrow.
TheDeadDrift.com?
.com, yep. Simple.
Okay. And TroutPredator.com.
Yep.
Where you've got a lot of useful information to educate folks there as well. Yeah, good.
Yeah, there's a lot. It's over, I think it's 3,700 members now, so it's grown quite a bit.
Oh, okay, good, good. Let's talk more about tailwaters. One question came in was, do tailwaters have seasons? In other words, like a freestone river would have, or do they remain stable pretty much?
Tailwater fisheries do have seasons. Now, I'm going to use a couple different examples here. On a river like the Beaverhead, okay, heavy fishing pressure, large fish, yes, the water temperature varies. However, the fly patterns that catch the most fish and the ways that you would fish them do not vary much. For example, on that river, there's some sow bugs, there's PMDs, there's a little, you know, some calabatus that come in from Clark Canyon Reservoir and midges. And on that river, you're going to do the best day in and day out with tiny food items, you know, size 20, 22 midges, even for these fish that are, you know, up to 26, 27 inches long. So in that aspect, it's not as seasonal. The only difference that I've noticed from fishing there at a couple of different times of the year is the fish fight a little bit harder, you know, in the summer when the water is a little bit warmer, their metabolism's a little bit higher. And, you know, I went there in the fall one time, they were a little bit more sluggish. However, the one common denominator was that the small flies caught big fish there. And those fish will rise. And they rise a little bit in the beginning of the PMD hatch until they get caught a lot. So you will get bigger fish on tailwaters until they've been caught a lot on dry flies and larger flies. Once they've been caught a bunch of times and the angling pressure goes right up, I think that the trout go to, yes, because, you know, it's a, what I would consider, you know, a safe food item. For example, it's easier for someone to present a nymph that properly or a dry fly that's a size 14 or a 16. Now, to do that with a fly that's a size 20, 22, 24 is a lot more difficult. So the fish get caught a lot on the larger flies, and then eventually they make a shift towards something that's smaller. And I think it's, you know, just like how Pavlov trained the dog, you know, with the bell. And the food, same thing. They get caught on it a bunch of times. They get hurt. Oh, this is no good. They stop. Now, on a river, you know, in the east, like, you know, well, I hate to use it, but the West Branch of the Delaware, these fish are very driven on feeding on insect hatches. So what happens is these fish will sit in the pools, you know, in the winter and in the slow water, and you'll get a lot of fish on small flies because behavioral drift takes place all the time. So you have a lot of small flies in the drift constantly there. Now, in the spring and in the summer and in the fall, when there's heavy insect hatching going on, those fish will go into the riffles and feed on the nymphs that are in the drift that are working their way to the surface. And then when the hatch is over, they'll rise, you know, very well sometimes, depending on how heavy the hatch is or the intensity of the insects that are hatching. However, the one thing is that the fish will get extremely difficult to catch on the surface, because we'll go back to tailwaters or low gradient fisheries again. The insects are floating by the fish very slowly due to the lack of velocity in the stream. So the fish have a lot of time to figure out if that insect's fake or not. So it's not like a... Yes, the drift has to be perfect. So you're not fishing where, in a situation on a freestone, where the fish only get 3 months to feed and the insect activity is excellent and they're just eating everything. There, they can be a little bit more selective because of the amount of food available to them for a longer period of time. And that's one of the reasons why tailwater fishing and catching a lot of fish can be very difficult for most people, because they're fished a lot, there's a lot of food, and that creates some pretty, you know, sticky situations, as I like to call them.
Right, right. Well, maybe we can talk later about your techniques for delivering those smaller flies. But that makes total sense what you just said, and I don't think a lot of people think that way about, you know, the issues that they're facing. So, yeah, that's really good. Thomas Murphy in Redmond, Washington, wanted to know how far, and we kind of talked about this, how far from a dam does a tailwater act like a tailwater? Can other geological situations cause similar conditions? Are tailwaters less affected by weather, such as rain? Kind of a two-part question. So I guess from what you said earlier, how long it acts like a tailwater is going to be determined by the depth of the lake, for one thing, and the gradient, I suppose. Huh? Irrigation.
Sorry. Well, also the velocity of water being released from the dam has a great effect on how long that's going to remain a quote-unquote tailwater fishery. Now, in some tailwater fisheries, the actual, what you would consider a real tailwater because of the, you know, sow bugs and the type of insects that like that pH between 7 and 9 is going to be limited by the bedrock and the creeks coming in, because the pH might be lowered or it might get raised out of that perfect zone. So geology of an area can certainly change the whole characteristic of a stream. For example, if you have a tailwater and the water is 45 degrees for 5 or 6 miles, and all of a sudden you have a river entering in that's 80 degrees, well, that's probably going to be the end of that cold water zone where the trout are going to be. So they're going to be found upstream of that. Or when they take the water out of the river and the water goes above 70 to 75, you'll have fish that might have been down in that latter part of the river during the, you know, winter, the fall, spring. They're going to move up into that cooler water to seek thermal refuge. So trout will move around a lot in tailwaters. Like I said, the geology can affect it. Now, are tailwaters less affected by weather such as rain? Yes, generally, unless you have a river that comes in near the dam. However, you'll usually have pretty good fishing after a rain for a while, depending on how much rain you get and how much rain the reservoir can actually hold before the capacity of the reservoir gets to 100%, and it either spills over the top of the dam or they release more water to keep that incoming rain at bay. However, the saving grace is you might have high flows, but generally the water is clear coming out of the dam. So you will even have opportunities to fish on tailwaters even after a heavy rain that causes all the freestone streams and surface water streams to become flooded out.
Well, you also have a change of fish species as you go down from the tailwater. I know, you know, again, using the bighorn as an example, or even the San Juan in New Mexico, you know, you'll have the rainbows up top more and the browns that like the warmer water down below more. So you may have to change your tactics based upon the type of fish as well, right?
Well, what I think happens there is the rainbows are generally more competitive, so they kind of push a lot of the fish out. You got to remember, rainbow trout in most of the places where they are in the United States, with the exception of California and some of the other western states right on the coast, rainbow trout are an invasive species. And anywhere you plant an invasive species, it's going to outcompete all the other native species. Now, brown trout are also an invasive species in the United States entirely. There were never brown trout here before they came over from Europe. So what you have are these total artificial fisheries, and you have two invasive species competing for each other for habitat. And it is very interesting how they will generally be separated. Now, one thing that's interesting to note is that if you read a lot of biologist reports, especially in the Taylor River, we'll use that one for an example, the Taylor River actually has more brown trout in it than rainbow trout. However, rainbow trout come up in the catch rates way higher percentage than the brown trout do. And I think that that's due to the rainbow trout being a more opportunistic feeder. So many people will think that there's more rainbow trout there, when in actuality the population might be balanced more than they think. So one thing I notice is, you know, when you go fishing, you catch more rainbow trout in a stream where rainbow trout and brown trout are both present due to the behavior of the fish. Like the bighorn, for example, you would think that there's almost entirely all rainbow trout in there. However, when you look at the biologist reports, you'll see that there is more brown trout in the bighorn than rainbow trout, which is very interesting because when you fish there, if you catch 25 fish, you know, almost 20 of them will be rainbow trout, and you'll catch 6 or 7 brown trout. Mm-hmm. So what happens is you have a more opportunistic fish with different feeding behaviors that is more readily caught by anglers.
Yeah.
I think that that's the, you know, the larger underlying reason why they're, you know, caught more.
Okay. A quick break again, and we'll come right back, so stick with me, folks. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. It's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Aaron Jasper about tailwaters. If you'd like to ask Aaron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Aaron, you know, we talk about tailwaters being potentially a year-round fishery, and we did get a couple of questions in, Rod in Oregon, Bob in New Mexico, and they're asking about, are there special considerations we should have for winter tailwater fishing? And then Bob was asking, during the winter months, should you be fishing further downstream where it's warmer or sticking up close to the top?
All right. Let's go back to the behavioral drifting. Now, In the winter months, there is not much hatching activity with the exception of midges on these streams. Now, all the insects in the stream bottom that are going to hatch later on in the year, they're all immature, so they're really small. So what happens is these insects all feed on the algae and the bacteria on the rocks. Now, every day in these streams, they detach themselves off those rocks and they drift helplessly and they swim down to a new area where they can feed again. So it's this phenomena that fuels the feeding of the trout in the tailwaters in the winter. Okay, so that's the one thing that I think about. Now, in the winter time on these tailwater fisheries, I will commonly fish size 22 to 24 nymphs. Any generic pattern works well, like WD-40s are fine. Any, you know, tiny pheasant tails, any generic nymph that can imitate a wide variety of food sources, because at that stage in their life, when they're really tiny, they almost all look identical. So you can't really tell the difference. Now, in the winter, the flows are generally low, so you don't have the sow bugs moving around as much as you do when the water is up and they're in the weed beds and the fluctuations can actually move them around. So during the winter months, I'm generally fishing with midge larvae, tiny mayfly nymphs, egg patterns. I'm not afraid to say it. That works well during those times of the months, because you know what? Trout are genetically driven to feed on eggs. So I always tell people, if you're not doing well, just put on a tiny egg and you'll get one. So it's eggs, midge larvae, small mayfly nymphs. Now, to get back to the question about below the dam. Now, it all depends on the air temperatures. Now, in a tailwater system, in the winter, like I said, the water is generally low. There's not a lot of fluctuations. The water is usually at its lowest of the whole year in the winter because they're storing the water to release it in the spring and the summer for various reasons. So when it's low like that, you can have good fishing down from the dam quite a ways when the weather's warm. for the reasons that, you know, he thinks, because the water gets warmed up as it flows downstream. Now, the fish populations might be evenly distributed. So if it were colder weather, if the weather was colder, I would fish closer up to the dam because the water temperature might be slightly warmer there than 10 miles below the dam. However, if it was reversed, if it was really warm out and you had a warm spell, like you guys are having 56 degrees, I mean, they're probably catching fish, you know, pretty close to where the frying pan dumps into the Roaring Fork right now because the water is warm and the fish are actively feeding. So it all depends on temperature, what your approach would be in that situation.
Okay, good things to think about. We're getting all kinds of questions coming in online here, too, so we're going to have to go on the attack on these questions and try to get them done. Scott Rice in Virginia asks, what's the best time to fish tailwaters? I'm not sure what he means time, if it means time of day or time of year, but maybe you could address both of those.
Time of the year, all year round, depending on the tailwater and where it is and what your how tough you want to be, for lack of a better phrase. If it's like 10 degrees out, zero, you're probably not going to want to go. However, the fish are there, and they will feed for some period of the day. So in the winter, you want to be on these streams from 10 till 3 p.m. because that's when the water temperature is going to spike up. There's lots of light. It's been light out for a while. The fish get a little more active. Now, in the spring, summer, and the fall, you don't have that one little peak of activity going on. In the spring, my strategy on the tailwaters is generally in the spring month, during the spring, is to fish lower down in the tailwater early in the day because the temperatures are warmer further down from the dam in the spring because of the air temperature. So I'll fish down lower on the tailwaters in the spring, and then as the day moves, you know, on and the temperatures get warmer, I will fish spots that are higher up in the tailwater. So you can fish them all day long during that time period. Now, in the west, in the summer, you have tremendous PMD hatches. So the middle of the day is good. And that's why in the west, you don't see many people get to the river until 9, 10, 11 o'clock because they don't have to. There's plenty of fish, there's plenty of insects, plenty of rising fish, plenty of nymphing, you know, opportunities in the middle of the day. Now, when I go on vacation out west, I get out there at 6 a.m. because you can catch a lot of fish because there's no one there and you can fish all the spots. So one of my little things is I get up at 6 and I'll fish till 10, 11 o'clock. When everyone starts getting out there, I'll have a lunch and then I'll come back out and enjoy the rest of the day. And then another interesting thing is out west, a lot of guys leave the river at 7 o'clock and it doesn't get dark out till 9:30. So they're missing that whole evening time fishing period that's excellent. You have spinner falls. You have the behavioral drift happen again. You have phenomenal fishing for that last 2.5 hours. And that's another time period where you're almost alone on the stream. There's just a few of the real diehard guys that will fish all day, generally the ones that are on vacation there.
Yeah. I know when we fish down the San Juan River, a lot of times we do what you were saying. We get up early, fish until lunchtime, go back to the hotel, you know, motel, and cool off because usually it was so darn hot, you know. And
yeah.
So we go back, cool off, have our lunch, take a nap, and then we'd go back out like 3 or 4, and then we'd stay until we couldn't see anymore, you know. And that worked out for a nice day. Now, we did get a question, and this is kind of talking about that. Boris in Ohio wanted to know, what do you do when the waiting anglers are side by side or the drift boats are lined up? Do you join the crowd or head out for quieter water? So you just gave one solution, it sounds like. Other people off asking about that. Well, Roman in Austria came in on the Internet. How do you deal with crowds? Dijon and Syracuse often struggle with heavily fished rivers. So we've got a lot of people concerned about the number of people on the river, too. So,
well,
how do you deal with that?
Well, one thing, I'll explain why there's so many people there. We have to remember that we're losing trout stream and trout habitat at a rapid rate. In the book that I had for my class, it said that since 1890 to present, we've lost over half the trout streams that we started off with. And we're going to lose another 40% of what we have left in the next 25 to 30 years. So what's happening is these tailwaters, because of the unique fisheries that they create below the dam, they're putting a lot of anglers in one place. So crowding is inevitable. The way you deal with the crowding is to change techniques, be adaptive, and do different things that other people aren't doing. Maybe fish smaller flies. As most guys, they don't fish size 20, 24 nymphs on most of these streams. They don't think that the fish eat them. They don't think that they can land a fish on a hook that small, but it does happen. Now, I found that some of the best fishing happens after the boats go by. The fish all move around, and then they get set back up in the same spot. And think about it. The fish in tailwaters are larger than the average trout in a freestone stream. So these fish need to feed more aggressively. So they really do need to feed to keep their mass. So those boats come by, those fish get right back in the middle of the stream, and the fish feed again. As a matter of fact, I think it bothers fishermen more than the fish. So when those boats come by, don't get upset about it. Just get ready to go fishing as soon as they get by. And that's about it. Now, the other thing is more of a common courtesy issue. No one should be standing super close to you. I mean, you know, some of these tailwaters, they're popular. You have to deal with it. You know, like the San Juan River would be a prime example. There's guys fishing, you know, 50, 60 feet away from each other. But you got to remember there that when you're standing in front of the fish there might be 500 fish standing in front of you. So the guy that's standing 60, 70 feet down from you really isn't interfering with your fishing. Yeah. So that's my main concern, is that is the person interfering with your fishing? I mean, if someone's rowing down a, you know, in a boat, they drop the anchor in front of where you're fishing, yes, that's interfering with your fishing. However, if you have enough space and you're comfortable with that, then you probably shouldn't move. Now, if there's somebody standing across from you or something you don't like, just move to another spot. There is enough stream for everyone to fish. So that would be my advice on that one.
Yeah, some people are very rude. I had that happen, in fact, on the San Juan, where I was fishing a small run, and a guy waded out just directly across from me. I mean, if we would have both reached out our rods, we probably could have touched tips. And I go, I got to put up my hands in the air, and I go, you know, what the hell?
Yeah.
I got a big river here. You got to fish right here. And, you know, it really irritated me that day, because there was plenty of other places, you know. And he says, well, I see fish there. And I said, well, yeah, so do I. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, there's fish 50 feet down, too.
Yeah. I don't know where I heard this. I heard this a long time ago, and I've always kind of kept it as my rule, is if you can see the color of your neighbor's fly line and tell what color it is, you're probably too close, you know. And so I kind of use that as a guide, you know, for myself, of how close I come to people. But
One funny one at the Bighorn one year, I was standing there and got situated to fish in the spot. And the drift boat comes, and he had his clients cast right off my rod tip. Now, I was mad and upset and aggravated for about a minute until I casted my line and it hooked the fish right away. So that kind of cured that one. So it's like, all right, whatever. Get one, and then I'll, you know, you move on. But you know what? That's really not the norm. Most people are pretty courteous.
Right.
And they know that, like, that's the place where you're going to be fishing, because it's the best, you know, opportunity to catch fish. So people are a little more lenient, and they generally are very nice. I mean, if everyone got mad at each other that are fishing these tailwaters, I would hate to see what it would look like. I mean, you could put up a boxing ring.
Real battle out there.
It would be a real battle.
Yeah. Well, you keep bringing up fishing the small, you know, size 20, 22, 24s. So why don't you give us some tips on fishing midges that small? Because you've mentioned it several times now. So give us a few secrets on how to present those small flies.
Well, generally with the smaller flies, the smaller nymphs, I'm going to veer away from the, you know, European style. So I'm going to fish with an indicator, because it's going to allow me to present those flies at a distance. Because most of these fish in the tailwaters, the boats don't spook them. Nothing spooks them. The only thing that will really spook these fish are actual people walking in the water. And, you know, I think it's because you're in their zone. Your feet are there. You're in with the fish. So that's one of the few things that's actually going to spook the fish there. Now, with the indicator, you can cast it 30, 40 feet up and across the stream, and you can present those flies at a distance. Now, below my indicator, I generally fish what would be considered almost a right angle nymphing rig. I have very thin tippet going to my split shot, so I can get my flies down to the bottom with a very minimal weight. So I'm generally using 5X below the indicator to get the flies down, and I'm trying to get away with as little weight as possible, generally number 4 or number 1 split shot in most of the tailwater scenarios, because the bottom structure isn't that great. So the weights are just going to slide across the bottom. It's almost like a sheet of glass. Now, to my nymphs, I'm generally fishing 5 to 7X and pretty long distance. I'm using almost 2 feet to my first nymph, and I'm generally degreasing the tippet to get that sheen off it, because I think that when that tippet turns in the sunlight, I'm using fluorocarbon, it reflects the light a little bit because of the grease, and that spooks the fish. So you want to have a long tippet between your split shot and the nymphs. Okay, so that it can move around more naturally in the current. Now, I like to use as light a tippet as I can get away with. Now, when you're fishing in a stream and the fish are large, like the beaverhead, for example, I'll make a trade-off. I will decide that I'm going to use 5X. I might get less bites. However, I'm going to get a higher percentage of those fish in. Yeah, you can go to the beaverhead and hook a lot of those 20 to 22, 23-inch wild trout on 6X, a lot. However, you're going to lose a lot. So I'd rather hook 12 and get 10 in than hook 20 and land 6. So that's a little bit of the strategies that you need to employ. You need to figure out a nymphing method that'll fish your flies at a great distance, and then you need to figure out what size tippet you're going to use based on the size of the fish. So, like for Colorado, where the rivers aren't as large and you can land them quite easily, that's why you see a lot of the guys fishing with 6 and 7X, because they can stay pretty close to the fish during the entire fight. Now, other rivers where the velocity of stream is higher, like the Bighorn, the Beaverhead, you can't fish with light tippet because you're just going to get the line snapped every time. So, right. Pick the tippet based upon the size of the fish and what you think you can get away with.
We had a question come in that relates to this on the Internet. Dick Van Buren, I don't know if that's his last name or where he's at, Van Buren. He says, how to get small flies, i.e. shrimp, 20 to 24 in size, with a wide enough hook gap that are capable of hanging onto a large fish through a long fight. So is that another variable that we have to deal with or concern ourselves with, is the hook gap on these small hooks?
Yes, definitely. My favorite hook for fishing these streams and, you know, landing these large fish is a Tiemco 2488H. It's a really heavy, wire hook, has a straight eye, so it has a wider gap, and it's modeled after the 2488, which is a great hook. However, on larger fish, it can bend. So that heavy wire hook works really well for the fish. Now, one little tip when you're fighting these fish is when the fish takes your fly and you set the hook downstream, so the hook gets driven right into the fish's jaw, you want to try not to change that angle. So you want to keep the rod over your downstream shoulder the same way you set that hook through the entire fight and keep tension on it. The only time these fish are going to spit that hook is when they get rolling on the surface and they cause a lot of commotion on the surface. And the way to stop that is just to drop the rod and pull them back under the surface, because the last thing you want is for that fat fish to be shaking its head on the surface, because that's when the bad stuff happens. So you don't want to get the fish near the surface until you're ready to net them. So that's one way to deal with that. Change your hook and change the angle in which you fight the fish, because you don't want to move that hook around, because that point's only so long. So moving the rod angles and changing that up can create a bigger hole in the fish's jaw, and eventually the hook will come out of the fish.
Now, we had another question on the Internet come in. T. Nice, Cornwall Bridge, I don't know if it's he or she. This person asks, how do you specifically target the bigger trout in the tailwaters?
That's an interesting one. Okay, now, in the tailwater fisheries, I've found that there's a pecking order of the fish within the river. Generally, the larger fish that I've caught, let's say, 26 inches to, almost 30, have been caught in the fastest water that they can be sitting in order, and in my opinion, is because they can get at the insects first. So it's that competitiveness within the population of fish that puts that fish in that spot. Now, another thing I found is that if you start catching a lot of small fish, you're probably not going to catch a big fish. So you want to target what I would consider the prime lie, like the spot where the fish will be sitting in the top of the riffle. They're generally there. One of the fish I got that was 26 and a half inches in the West Branch of the Delaware, I saw the thing, and drift boats came by, and the fish kept on going right back to its same spot. And eventually I was able to make a cast and catch them. And that fish wasn't very difficult to catch. You just had to be observant. Now, some of the other large fish that I've caught actually come out of water where you don't think the fish are going to be. Now, we'll go back to tailwater as being heavily pressured, right? Now, heavy fishing pressure, the fish will adjust because tailwaters are kind of like a fish tank. It's just, it's almost the same every time you go there. Within, a little bit of, range. It's, the water might be higher, might be lower, but it's very similar. Now, some of the big fish that you catch in a lot of these tailwaters out west and east, you'll see them in some really, what most guys would think of is like water that they're not going to fish. Like one fish that I got in the West Branch last year, almost 29 inches, was sitting in a foot of water, and another one, it was on the bank where people walk through to go fish the best spot. So I think that fish goes there because no one's trying to catch him, and he's been conditioned that that's where he's going to go feed. So
and he's
one
safe
of the,
there all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a safety zone. And one of the, other times is during increased flows or when the fish are moving around the mouths of the rivers to come in and spawn, and that'll go along with the, the Croton River, the Croton system. Is the one on your homepage was caught from the Croton system on an indicator rig in a stream in the fall. And that fish was, a little bit in excess of 10 pounds, and that's not a fish that you see in those streams. So also time of the year comes into play. If the river feeds a lake and there's trout in the lake, you can be sure that those fish are going to migrate in there during some time of the year. They're going to be in there in the fall, generally, if it's brown trout, and in the spring, if it's rainbow trout. Or, if the river is warmer than the lake, it's going to draw those fish in during the spring because the lake's cold and the river's a little bit warmer, so they gather around those mouths of the streams during the spring months as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chuck in Ohio asks, is there a good way to determine the best starting weight, in parentheses, yes, shot, as a rule of thumb on your first cast? Are weighted flies more suitable?
No, for tailwater, since you're generally fishing with small flies, and you actually want your flies to dead drift because the water is clearer, there's less turbulence, the water is not, getting pushed around much by rocks, you want to generally use split shot there so you can present your flies a little bit more naturally to the fish. So my general rule of thumb is if you're fishing in a foot of water or less, you want to start off with one number four, a split shot, and a very short distance, 2 feet from the indicator. Now, if you're fishing in water that has a little more volume, like size of like the Ruby, like 30 to 60 feet, you want to use size one split shot generally. Now, if you're fishing a large river with lots of volume, you'd want to start off with a BB split shot. Then it's all up to the angler to make the adjustments. When the water is heavier and it's faster, you might want to put on 2 BBs or 2 number 1s. So shallow water, generally a number 4. Rivers that have, medium-sized rivers with medium current speeds, you want to use number 1. And large volume, you'd want to use BBs. And then adjust the amount of, number 4s, 1s, or BBs with what you need to get that strike indicator to slow down. And the way that I gauge that is, you want to see your strike indicator moving slower than the current speed on the top. So you should see the water and the bubbles passing your strike indicator up. So when that happens, you want to slow it down and pay attention to the indicator and how fast that's moving in relation to the surface current. So that, so you know, covers moving, what you want to watch out for.
Yeah, that's a really good tip. So if it's, if your indicator is moving the same speed as the bubbles and so forth of the river, then that means you're light in weight and free floating through the water column, right, and not getting down.
Yes, and that would be the time. Yeah, and that would also be a time where you might want to put on more weight and then lengthen the amount of line below your strike indicator to make it longer.
So, yeah, because you might have enough weight, but you're just not long enough, potentially.
Yeah, so you have to play around with it. And, you know, it's a trial and error thing. You have to experiment, and then when you see what works and you see the indicator going slower than the current, you're usually going to catch fish. That's usually, like, the recipe for success.
Mm. It's funny. Out of all the – I've done over 160 shows now here. I don't think anybody's ever shared that tip before, so – I think that's really interesting, because I think most people struggle with that, you know. How much do I put on, and do I have enough, and how do I tell, you know? So that's a good tip that you just shared with everybody.
Well, there's definitely an indicator for the indicator.
Yeah.
Like when I do guide trips and used to teach indicator and nymphing clinics a lot, I would definitely tell them all the time that the indicator tells you how well you're fishing your flies. If it's going slower than the current, you're fishing your flies right. If you're getting hung up all the time, lessen the weight, do something. Shorten up the distance between the weight and the split shot, but always change it. However, when you get it right, you're going to catch fish in these situations. Mm-hmm. Everything's in your favor. It's just a matter of making enough drifts in that area in front of the fish, and you're eventually going to get them.
And Boris in Ohio asked about classic wet fly approach in tailwaters. He wants to know if that's something that you use. And I know you're a wet fly, you and Davey are very familiar with that. So do you use the classic wet fly approach in tailwaters, or is that not appropriate?
No, it definitely works. It depends on the size of the stream. On a river, let's go with the Delaware, where it's wide open, you can stand, you know, upstream of the fish, and you can present those flies down and across in a dead drift, it works excellent. If the fish are feeding actively in the riffle, you can use the upstream presentation for those fish, and you can lift the rod as they come to you to imitate those insects coming to the surface. Now, the one thing that I do, and Davey does as well, is we'll play around with the flies that we actually use. We'll use those presentations. However, it might not always be done with quote-unquote wet flies. We might use unweighted nymphs. We might use a lightly weighted nymph, but the manner of the presentations will be the same. However, the flies used will be different, but we're still trying to achieve the same thing. Now, as far as the flies on tailwaters, generally, more specific imitations work well. Like, you know, sometimes the Silver Invicta works well. Like, on the Neversink one time, it's funny, when Davey took me fishing a number of years ago, we went to the stretch on the Neversink, and I was like, you know, I really can't get that many fish out of here. And he goes, all right, let's see. And then 5 minutes later, he gets like an 18-inch fish, and then 10 minutes after that, there's like a 23-inch fish in the line, and then, you know, a couple minutes later, he's got like a 12-inch fish, and I'm just like, wow. And he got like, you know, almost two dozen fish out of this very nondescript riffle by just working it methodically down and across. And the Neversink River is a very fertile tailwater where the fish get up in these shallow riffles, and I would catch a few fish there on, you know, fishing dry dropper. However, he clobbered them by fishing wet flies in a traditional manner. And that was when I really saw the light. I was like, wow, I can only catch four or five fish out of here. And he got a couple dozen. It's like, ding, wow. Ding, ding, the light went off. So, yes, every technique has its time when it's going to be, when it's going to work well. In very shallow, riffled water where the fish are sitting, wet flies work well. And he'll fish a lot of 6X and real tiny wet flies, too, like 18 and 20, little soft hackles. And that's similar to what we're doing with the little nymphs. And you have to realize one thing, is that you can't go to a stream and say, I'm going to use wet flies and that's it, or I'm going to fish with a dry fly and that's it. It's about matching up what the river is telling you to do with a technique that you know. So when these fish are actively feeding on insects, wet flies and soft tackles work really, really well. However, when the fish are put down and they're feeding, you know, on small food items during certain parts of the day, the wet flies and the soft tackles aren't going to be successful. And you're going to see that in your catch rates. You know, when the insects are hatching, the fish are feeding, you're going to get a lot of fish on wet flies and soft hackles, fished right underneath the surface of the stream, and then it's going to slow down, and that tells you that you should try something else. So don't fish the same technique all the time, because these, you know, fisheries are very dynamic with the fishing pressure and everything, that you need to constantly be changing gears. Like one day, Roger, when I was fishing, on the Delaware, actually, I fished, I think it was like 6 different techniques in one day. And every single technique that I tried caught fish. So that just says, you know, when one thing stops working, think about the next thing. You might have to go from dry dropper to wet flies and soft tackles to dry flies to possibly streamers to nymphing, you know, with no split shot on the line, with just a single fly. The permutations are endless. And the more things that you know how to do, the more successful you're going to be.
Okay, you had mentioned dry dropper there a couple times, too. We got a couple questions here. Chris Doyle was asking about what attractors you use in dry attractors, absent a hatch, and also Rick Takahashi in Fort Collins, Colorado, asked about how do you set up your rig for dry flies and nymphs, and he also asked about terrestrial patterns and tailwaters. So I know earlier you said, you know, the dry fly action is tough because of, you know, the slowness of the water, the clarity of the water, and so forth. Is a dry dropper a combination that you would use in a tailwater, or is that something you kind of steer away from?
No, it depends on what the fish are doing. Dry dropper can be excellent in tailwater situations, provided that the fish are up suspended in the water column actively feeding. Like, sometimes you'll see fish that are, you know, suspended in the water column, and you need your nymph to be suspended as well. So dry dropper works very, very well in those situations. Now, dry fly fishing in tailwaters is a separate animal. A lot of times when you're fishing in tailwater systems, we said the fish are, you know, repeatedly caught. And a lot of times I'll downsize my tackle. Like, most guys will fish with a 9'5" weight. I like to use a 9'3" weight, because on a trip to France, I fished for some of the most difficult trout I've ever seen in my life. Not a tailwater stream. However, the lessons learned from there I could take into the more heavily fished tailwaters. And I went to this river in France, and my friend said, I need a 7-meter long leader. So 7 times, you know, 39 inches is almost 26, 27 feet. And I was like, no, you don't need this. Coming, you know, from the United States, a lot of fish, you know, we do have a lot of fish here as compared to there. So I make the first cast. I'm using a 9'2" weight, mind you. I have 7X tipping onto my fly, about an 18-foot leader. I cast that line in the water, and all you saw were wakes of trout all over the place. So I gave up. I put on the longer leader, and the trout that were difficult to catch and spooked were not so difficult to catch with the longer leader. So what I did when I came home is I started using these leaders that were 22, 23, 24 feet in length with really, really long tippets, you know, 4 to 5 feet of tippet, and that enabled me to catch some fish in situations that I wasn't able to catch those fish before. So it's something that I learned from something completely different that translated directly into something that I needed to do. So when I came home from France, my friend, you know, I was catching a lot of nice-sized fish, you know, at the West Branch, and it was one of those, like, low-water summers where the fish have just been beat into submission almost, and they were almost impossible to catch. And I would go there with this super long leader, and fish that guys would give up on, you can come from behind them, you know, after they're done, and catch those fish. So everybody thought that I was nymphing, when in actuality, I was dry-fly fishing that whole summer, because I was having fun with the new thing that I learned. So, you know, it's pretty exciting to take something from Europe, bring it over here, and it works way better than anything that I, you know, have ever tried there. Dry fly fishing, that is. Now, to get back to Rick's question about the terrestrials in the tailwater river systems, you got to remember one thing. In the East, we don't have as good tailwater fishing as they do in the West with terrestrials. Our rivers, if you made an, you know, an imaginary picture in front of you. The banks are generally very shallow, and there's a very well-defined channel in the middle of the river. Now, that makes it such that the fish don't sit on the banks in the same way that they do out west. Out west, the rivers, you know, flow through meadows, there's grasshoppers, there's lots of ants, there's lots of beetles, and the water tends to be deep on one shore or the other. Okay, so in a river like the Dream Stream in Colorado, there's lots of, you know, bushes and brush and grass along the bank, and that's the perfect habitat for ants and beetles and the grasshoppers. So there, you will catch fish in the tailwaters on terrestrial patterns more frequently than you will in the east, due to the way the river actually is and the habitat that surrounds the river. So, you know, when you have high grasses along the bank, you generally have very good terrestrials, provided right. that the water is deep along the bank in a spot where a fish can sit. Right. So that's the deciding thing about the terrestrial fishing in the tailwaters, is the depth along the shore and the vegetation along the shore.
Okay. A couple of questions here, one from Scott Rice in Virginia, another one from Jerry Kemple in Missouri. Both asked about, do you notice a difference in fishing whether the water is rising or falling in the tailwater? Does the bite better one way or the other, or does it not make a difference?
If you're fishing on a river where they're generating power, when that water starts to come up, the first little bit can be some really fast and furious fishing. I was fishing with a friend, Tori Collins, on the South Holston River in Tennessee, and you could not beat the nymph bite as that water was coming up. As a matter of fact, we would figure out where we could start fishing, fish the rise of the water, get in the car, and fish it a few different times throughout the stream course. And some of the larger fish that we caught during the one trip were caught on that rise of water. Okay. Now, on the fall of the water, because I'm sure he's talking about rivers that have power generation, the fall of the water can be excellent. However, when it bottoms out and it gets the lowest it's going to be before the generation, the fishing usually slows down because the fish are spooky, they're wary, they're trying to, you know, they're scattering about trying to find a new holding lie in that shallower, lower water. So they're a little bit, you know, more skittish. Now, when the water is coming up, it's the opposite. They get pushed to the shore. They're basically getting thrown around. And a lot of the Tennessee Valley, you know, authority streams are of that nature. The water comes up rapidly. It displaces everything. There's food available, and the trout move around, and they're very easy to catch. Mm-hmm. And then when the water gets low, you have very good fishing. Then all of a sudden, it's like someone turns off the faucet, the water's low, and the fishing gets somewhat difficult again.
Okay, Aaron, we're getting short on time here. I've got a bunch of questions on the Internet. I want you to answer them as quickly as possible, okay, in as few words as possible so we can knock off a whole bunch of these. Okay, Alec wants to know what you consider the best tailwater that you fished in the U.S.
Honestly, for challenge and everything, I would say the West Branch of the Delaware, and I would say the Beaverhead would be number two.
Okay, and that's it. That's all you get.
Okay, that's fine.
All right, next one. What are your top half dozen tailwater nymphs?
Tailwater nymphs, WD-40, RS-2, Miracle Nymph, Black Beauty, and Bar Merger, Juju Betis, Juju Midge, all that stuff.
Good. Okay, that was for Rick in Simsbury. Tori in Torrington, who are your mentors in learning to fly fish tailwaters?
Well, Tori knows a lot himself, so let's see. We got Tori. Davey taught me a lot. And then a lot of it, you know, I learned trial and error, just going a lot. I mean, you know, like one of the things that I'm lucky is I have a job where I can fish my brains out and travel all summer to, you know, just fish. And that, you know, that's all I do. Now, this year I'm going to take a little beating with the arm. But, you know, during the summer I think I fish almost every day. So it's really just time. And you know what the true mentor is in this whole thing? The fish. If you're doing well and you're catching a lot of fish, keep going. If you're not catching a lot of fish, back off, get a new game plan, and come back.
Okay. Thomas Murphy in Redmond, this goes back to what you said earlier, and I was kind of curious about this too. It says, what is causing the loss of trout waters and what can be done? Is it the water levels dropping, invasive species, pollutants, all of the above?
I would say that logging is very, very high on the list. And then climate change. Now, I'm not going to get into debate whether climate change is man or not. You know, I think it was all man, but a couple classes, I'm rethinking that. However, climate change is happening. So I think that climate change, to some degree, is causing the loss of trout habitat. Now, will 100 years from now be different than what it is today? Probably, because this is all cyclical. However, you know, the trout streams are getting warmer. You know, like you said, the last few years, the water's been lower. We had our warmest year on record last year. So we're having warmer summers, crazier, you know, very, very radical variances in weather. So things are different now than they were over 100 years ago. So I think that the logging and the, you know, exploitation of natural resources and to some degree climate change is what's causing our, you know, fisheries to be in decline.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we do have more people on the planet, you know. In fact,
yes,
more people fishing, you know, than when I was a kid. And more people enjoying the outdoors. I mean, whether you're hiking, you know, backpacking, cross-country skiing, you just see more people, you know. So it's got to take a toll as well. Well, we're out of time here, but let's see here. Sorry we didn't get through all these questions, but we had a lot of people on tonight and a lot of questions coming in. And folks, we did the best we could. But hang tight with us. We're going to give away that membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And, of course, Aaron's new DVD, Mastering the Dead Drift, Indicator Nymphing Simplified and Perfected. So stick with me a couple more minutes, and then we'll do just that, give away those prizes, and we'll be finished for the night. So, Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and a sport network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or you can call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd truly appreciate it. So now it's time to give away some prizes here. So let me get my database up and running here, and we'll do just that. Our first prize is going to be a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and we all know that that's a great organization to be part of, and international, both freshwater and saltwater. And let's see who we got for that. Ron Legg in Oregon. Ron Legg in Oregon. So congratulations, Ron. We'll get you fixed up with a one-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers. And for those of you that aren't familiar with it, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and you'll learn more about Federation. Okay, now one-year membership to the Fly Fusion magazine out of Calgary, Canada. And we have a Canuck that won that, oddly enough, Cam Millen. Cam Millen, or Malone. I'm not sure what it is, in Alberta, Canada. So congratulations, Cam. And for those of you that want to learn more about Fly Fusion Magazine, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Okay, time to give away Aaron's DVD. I know you're all chomping at the bit to get this DVD after hearing what Aaron had to say tonight, so I know it's going to be a good one. So we're going to do a two-part question, and first part is, Aaron mentioned that there was one insect that is probably the most common insect, especially during the winter months in a tailwater fishery. What is that insect, and what was the hook, both the brand name and number of the hook he had mentioned? So you got to get both of these, right? The hook that he mentioned that had a, for smaller flies, I should say. I think it's the only one. And let's see here. I've got, now help me out with this, Aaron. I've got an answer here. Midge and TMC 2488H.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it?
Yep.
That's it. Okay, Dean, you won again. Dean's won a bunch of times. He must have. There's another. Well, we got a bunch of right answers here as I'm going through here. But Dean's our winner tonight and fast. So, Dean, I know you've probably sent this to me before, but send me your address so that either online here through the text box or at info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get Aaron to send you out one of his new DVDs as soon as they come off the press.
Now, tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Oh, okay. Perfect timing, huh? Perfect timing. So, and for those, again, that didn't win, go ahead, Aaron, and share that website, that hard-to-remember website address for your new DVD.
Yeah, it's really simple. It's www.thedeaddrift.com, and it's over 3.5 hours of instruction on how to do it.
Oh, wow.
So you get the casting, flies, tackle selection, and then multiple on-stream scenarios to demonstrate the tactic being used on a wide variety of different varying conditions.
Terrific.
On some
terrific.
Very popular streams.
Yeah, yeah, terrific. Well, thanks for sharing that. Thanks for going out and doing all that. I'm sure it was hard work doing all that fishing across the country. Huh?
Yeah, it was real hard work.
Well, thanks for being on the show again, Aaron. We've had you on several times. It's always a pleasure, and you always have just a load of great information to share with us. So I appreciate you being on the show again.
You're welcome.
And next show in February, next month on the 6th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to be interviewing Ralph Cutter again. And our topic for that show will be Golden Trout of the High Sierras. So Ralph Cutter spent, and get this, guys, Ralph Cutter spent his first nine-month honeymoon hiking through the Sierras with his new wife, Lisa, going through nearly every pass and fishing many of the waters in the Sierras. So the Sierras are home of the golden trout, California state fish, but it's not easy to fish for them. Listen in to hear how Ralph approaches this. He'll tell us a few of his secrets on fly fishing for golden trout in the high Sierras. So tune in, and it should be a good show. We would also like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. And if you think you'd benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-95-1673, extension 8. We'd be happy to explain the options available to you again. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. So don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.